We're going to talk about technology on the program today, and we want to talk about some of the ways it's being used to solve social problems or social issues. And as part of that conversation, we want to talk about who gets to decide just what is constructive and what isn't. We'll be having that conversation in a few minutes when we talk about how some observers are saying that too many of the feminist debates playing out online too often cross the line these days from constructive dialogue to destructive personal attack. We're coming out of that article in The Nation called Feminism's Toxic Twitter Wars. We will talk to some of the people who were quoted in the piece and who are part of that debate that's coming up. But first, we want to talk about how some hackers are trying to use technology to solve social problems. Organizers of a hackathon in Oakland, California are asking whether an app could have saved Trayvon Martin. It's part of Startup Weekend in Oakland. It's being called the first global hackathon for black male achievement, and we are joined now by two organizers of the event. Kalima Pryforce is co-founder of Kino Labs. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ayori Selassie is project manager at Salesforce.com, as well as co-founder and director at Pitch Mixer. You might remember her from our Blacks in Tech series last year. Ayori, welcome back to you. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Kalima Pryforce, could you just start by telling folks who don't know, what is a hackathon?
Sure. So a hackathon is an event that usually lasts 24 hours, 48 hours. And in that moment where developers, that's people who are technologists, designers, artists, and innovators, people with ideas to solve big problems, come together. And it's kind of a sort of immersive experience. And in those moments that they are together, they are able to create a solution, build a solution.
And just to clarify, it isn't just black males who are invited to this hackathon, just to be clear about that. You know, everybody who wants to participate is invited to participate. But why this particular focus on black male achievement? Why? How did this particular idea come about?
So with hackathons, anyone who walks into your day-to-day hackathon, the hackathon that happens every week, especially in Silicon Valley, what you find is that they tend to be homogenous environments. That hackathons emerge out of big tech companies. They emerge out of sort of Ivy League institutions. And they're predominantly white. They're predominantly male. And they are predominantly sort of middle to upper income class. And so... So recently, people have been exploring this idea of inclusion verticals, and that is hackathons that are able to tackle social issues around, let's say, women's issues. But there haven't really been a lot of hackathons that are focused on issues like black male achievement. And so we decided to create that, to create the sort of deeper level of engagement of young black males, their issues, and with the larger sort of Silicon Valley, Oakland community.
Ayo, do you want to pick up the thread here? I mean, it's part of the idea that if you change the conversation, that more people will want to participate in the conversation?
Oh, yeah. It's even beyond that. Just last night, we did a venture design workshop in Oakland at the Impact Hub Oakland. And I was wondering who was going to show up. This was in preparation for our hackathon, which starts on Friday. And we had four young black men in high school, and then we had a bunch of adults as well. And primarily African-American, but there were some Indians there, there were some Asians there as well. And the thing is that it doesn't shock me anymore is that when you make a space for them and you say, we especially want you to show up, they show up and they're excited.
So I have to ask you about this Trayvon Martin issue. It's all over the literature for your event. Could an app have saved Trayvon Martin? How?
That's a great idea. I mean, that's a great question. What it points to is that that because of this sort of homogenous environments that exist within the tech world and even in the social entrepreneurship innovation world, then that means that a lot of the problems and solutions become sort of limited in scope. And so could an app have saved Trayvon Martin is a great place to start when we start thinking about, okay, are we really building sort of an app ecosystem that is inclusive? So when George Zimmerman approached Trayvon Martin, Trayvon Martin had a phone in his hand. And so it engaged people to think about, Is there a button that he could have pressed that may have sort of altered the situation? But even bigger than that situation is, well, maybe Trayvon, the app that could have saved Trayvon Martin is an app that probably should have been built by Trayvon Martin. And how do we start building apps for the Trayvon Martins of the world rather than the George Zimmermans?
But, you know, to that end, though, as you know, because you were part of our series in December about Blacks in Tech, we had, you know, conversations both on the radio and we also had conversations on social media where we kind of addressed some of these questions. I just want to remind you of a conversation we had with Ciara Chase, who's a middle school student, and we spoke with as part of the series, and she had this idea of an app to help solve kidnapping cases, you know, flowing from the idea that you know, some people seem to come to the attention of the authorities more quickly than others. And I just want to play a short clip from the conversation we had with her.
For our app, it's basically so a parent can post their child's kidnapping, because without the app, you have to go through like a lot of police reports or post signs and stuff, so find your child. But for the app, if you find that your child is missing, you're able to post it, and anyone that has information about the child is able to comment under the post so they can help you in a faster way.
So, you know, Ayoria, as I said, this is a middle school student, so I think it speaks to your point that if you ask people the question, you know, sometimes they come up with the answer. You know, but to that end, it's my understanding that some of the big names like Google and Facebook are not participating. Do they normally come to hackathons, and why do you think they're not coming to this one?
Well, absolutely, they are coming. Several of our mentors are from companies like Google, from Google, from Salesforce. And so what we've really seen is that the employees have really responded to this concept of solving social problems using technology. And what we've done is we've given them the space and the structure to say this is going to be an event where we're able to do all the outreach to actually bring the young people and make sure that the folks who are here are incredibly gifted and talented and really able to leverage the opportunity for mentorship and support that we're giving during this hackathon.
Kalima, I obviously want to keep the space open for kind of the ideas to come wherever they come from. But what do you have an idea in your head of what would constitute success for this? Do you need to walk away with a specific app or a specific product? Or is it just the fact of people getting together to think about this issue? Is that enough?
Well, I believe that that we're looking at success through several ways. I mean, the metrics of, okay, yes, we have over 50 young Black males who we call our trailblazers who are going to be engaged in this process, and an app is going to be produced. Several apps are going to be produced. Wonderful. That's great. But on the other side is the effect that it will have on these professionals who are working alongside them. And that the problem is that, I've gotten emails where you have developers from Google, from Facebook, from a lot of these companies who are saying, well, I am uncomfortable working with young Black males.
Really? You've had people say this to you directly,
yes,
that they're uncomfortable working with young Black males? Why?
Yes. I believe it's a distance thing. It's, of course, it's sort of media perceptions, depictions that a lot of the conversations that are around Black males, especially young Black males, tend to be deficit conversations, tends to be what the issues are. Here are the statistics and here are the problems. But they don't tend to be sort of focused on Black male strengths, their potential, their untapped potential. So there aren't asset conversations. And so of course, I mean, you know, it's. I don't think it's wholly their fault. It's just the society that we live in, where these young Black males and are attached to these stereotype threats. So if they haven't interacted with young Black males in the towns that they're from the cities that they're from, and also in the companies where they work at, here it is. They're in Oakland. They're interacting with these young Black males, and so I can imagine what the kind of trepidation that they may have. I don't think it's a harsh judgment coming from them.
Are some of the people who sent you these emails going to come? Or are they saying, or did they say to you, that's why I'm not coming, because I'm not comfortable?
Well, I think that that's been the work that Ayuri and I have in trying to communicate what the Black male achievement, what the Black male achievement message is that that when we work together, especially as you know, as Americans, you know, in this country, that when we work together and we start to sort of tear down the walls that separate us, especially the walls in our minds, then we can build some really amazing things together. And so when we convey that message, that's what get, lets them go, okay, all right, I'm there. And okay. What's really important that, that I have to add as well is that when we found out that a lot of our trailblazers don't have laptops to participate, some of them have said, hey, you know, I have an extra laptop, or I have a Chromebook or something I want to provide. And so it's been a really community driven support.
You only have 30 seconds left. Give me a final thought, please.
Yeah, I think the main thing that we're focused on is empathy, community engagement, and passion and excitement. And what we really want to do is give all of these young people, all these people in our community, an opportunity to get addicted, joyfully addicted to entrepreneurship and technology. And I believe that's exactly the outcome that we're going to get from this event. And it's going to be a game changer. And we're going to see this replicated all around the world.
Okay, well, you got to come back and tell us what are some of the ideas that they came up with, assuming they're not secret. Okay. Ayuri Selassie is product manager at Salesforce.com, as well as co-founder and director of Pitch Mixer. Kalima Pryforce is co-founder of Kino Labs. They both join us from member station KQED just ahead of Startup Week in Oakland, Black Male Achievement, which runs this weekend. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's almost like the police have a time machine. So says reporter Craig Timberg of a new surveillance system he describes in the Washington Post. It is an array of 12 cameras that can be mounted on the belly of a small plane. Over the course of several hours, they can intermittently photograph an area the size of a small U.S. city. When police get word of a crime, they simply consult the camera's footage, starting at the scene of the crime and following the perpetrator's car, either forward to his current whereabouts or backward to where he started his day, often at home. For more on how it works and why some critics are sounding alarms, we're joined by Craig Timberg. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to be clear here. This is not video surveillance, right? This is basically an array that takes photographs over an extended period of time.
That's right. It takes one picture every second for 6 hours, and in some cases for the longer flights, 9 hours.
And just how good a resolution are we talking about? I know in the spy movies, it seems like you can zoom in and see someone's face, you know, like from outer space.
Right. You couldn't tell that they're reading a copy of The New Yorker or anything. But an individual appears as a single pixel, so like basically almost like a speck of dust. A vehicle is a little easier to see. The crucial thing about this technology is they can watch your movements over time. So even if you're a speck of dust, if they watch you as a speck of dust move between your home and your workplace and back, they know who you are.
Now, talk about where these cameras have already been used and where have they actually helped solve crimes?
They've been used most heavily at this point in Mexican border cities such as Juarez, where they've helped solve quite a few murders. But they've also been flown on a demonstration basis over Baltimore, Philadelphia, Dayton, Compton. They've been flown over NASCAR races, and they were even flown over Sarah Palin's announcement as vice presidential nominee in 2008 in Dayton, Ohio.
Now, talk about where they have been helpful in terms of investigations.
Because they've been used much more widely over the border in Mexico, the largest number of successes, if you will, are over there. But in flying over Dayton, they have, for example, been able to help track down who a robber is. As they get reports of shots fired, for example, at a Subway sandwich shop, they'll look and see who was leaving the Subway sandwich shop at that moment and where they go next. And with that, they can help solve crimes. In one case in Dayton, they had a report of a burglary. And they were able to report down to police, you know, go look for a white truck leaving such and such an address at this time. And they were able to catch up with the truck before it got home. And the stolen goods were right in the back.
So in your report, you say that the inventor essentially crafted a kind of privacy policy on his own, right? He worked with the ACLU to come up with some restrictions. Describe what those safeguards are.
The privacy policy the company has adopted limits who can look at these images and under what circumstances. So police can't just sort of troll through the across the ground and watch everybody and every vehicle is kind of looking for things to go wrong. What they do is if there's a report of a crime or shots fired, they can turn on this imagery and see what's happening both in the future and what happened in the past as people come together for a crime and then scatter after it's committed.
Now, the Supreme Court has been wrestling with the constitutionality of surveillance technology like this. Do we have any sense about whether this system crosses any legal lines?
I don't think there's any reason to think that it crosses any legal lines as they exist now. The Supreme Court has basically said, you know, if you're flying over something and you're looking at something that's visible to the naked eye, the police have a right to take pictures of it. Now, the civil liberties groups have been arguing fairly strenuously that this kind of technology is really a game changer, that if you can loiter over a place for hours, that it's really a different kind of technology that the courts need to rethink. And there's a push toward that end. I think the courts will have to revisit this at some point.
Washington Post reporter Craig Timberg, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
So we're staying in the world of sports because today marks the official opening of the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. And because we're going to be spending so much time watching events from Sochi in the next couple of weeks, we thought it would be fun to learn more about Sochi, the region, the history, and to try to learn about some of the pageantry we will be witnessing. So we've called Jennifer Yeremeva. She is a Russian historian and blogger. Jennifer and her family divide their time between Moscow and Western Massachusetts. And we actually caught up with her in Amherst, Massachusetts now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So Jennifer, first, does Sochi translate into something in English?
You know, it's interesting. There are a lot of different stories behind the name of Sochi. It may be the name of a ubiquitous tribe down there called the Sochi, but more likely is the fact that it was originally a slave market, and an ancient word, sha-cha, means to sell a head.
Oh, dear.
So that's a rather, you can take your pick.
Oh, dear, that's a little
two.
Ominous. Okay. So you've started telling us a little bit about the history of the place. I mean, I didn't know about that. It kind of puts a little damper on things. But we know of it as a resort city, right, on the Black Sea. Who's been going there all these years?
Well, it's Russia's largest resort city, but it's really only been popular since the communist era. Joseph Stalin made it the must-go place because he had his favorite dacha there. And Sochi was developed really as a proletarian response to another Black Sea resort, which is called Yalta, which is currently in Ukraine, but during Imperial Russia was the place where the czars and the aristocrats had their beautiful Italian marble villas. And that's where the peace conference in 1945 was. Sochi is really more of a proletarian variant of that. It was for the masses, so there were a lot of
sanatoria. The people's resort.
Yeah,
the people's resort.
Yeah. Exactly.
So we're hearing that one of the reasons that President Putin was so keen on the Olympics is that he wanted to show off the culture. You know, is pomp and pageantry a big part of Russian history, and how do you think that's going to play out during the Olympics?
I think that it's central to Russian culture. Russia has a fascinating history, and symbolism is really important. And we're going to be seeing a lot of symbols of not only Russia's history, but of Russia's future as well.
Well, give an example, if you would.
Well, I think children as the future of Russia is a very important moment that we're going to see hit again and again. There are a lot of children going to be involved in the Olympics. Russia's been concerned about declining birth rate for several years now. So I think this is an opportunity to talk about a brighter future for Russia's younger people.
Now, leading up to the Olympics, that there's been, you know, some bad press already, unfinished hotel rooms, kind of water that looks a little bit more interesting than most people kind of like their drinking water to look. You know, some of the designs of the bathrooms, people are like, what's going on here? How are people reacting to this? I know you kind of go back and forth and you follow the news and you have a blog and so forth. How is this being reported in Russia, and how are people responding to this?
It is being reported in Russia. And Russians have a fantastic sense of humor. They love to joke about themselves and their country and their politics. They don't love it so much when other people, like outsiders and foreigners, do. And I think that they are a little bit disappointed that the rest of the world seems to be indulging in a little healthy pre-Olympic schadenfreude that they feel is unjustified. They've put a lot of effort into getting Sochi ready for the Games, and I think they're hoping that as soon as the opening ceremonies take place, that the emphasis on the toilet tweeting will stop.
What would make it a success, you think, in the eyes of the Russians? Clearly, if there's a terrorist incident, that's going to be a terrible thing. So kind of like setting that to the side, but sort of apart from that.
That would dampen the mood. But I think that that's unlikely. They've taken immense precautions to secure the city. I think for them, if there are very few technological hitches with the actual venues, and if the athletes are happy and reflect that in the way that they interact with the press, that will be seen as a win.
Jennifer Yeremeva is a blogger and author of the new book, Lenin Lives Next Door, Marriage, Martinis, and Mayhem in Moscow. She joined us from New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Enjoy.
Coming up, comedian Jerry Seinfeld doesn't think much of calls to bring more diversity to comedy.
People think it's the census or something. I mean, this has got to represent the actual pie chart of America. Who cares?
Not everybody's laughing. Does Seinfeld have a point, or is he missing something? The Barbershop Guys offer their punchlines. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
For crews fighting wildfires, the ability to get information is crucial. A breakdown in communications was one factor that led to the deaths last year of 19 firefighters in Arizona. In 2011, two crew members died in Florida while fighting a blaze. With those accidents in mind, Florida has begun using a new radio tracking system. NPR's Greg Allen reports that even through smoke and fire, it allows managers to pinpoint firefighters' locations.
In the West, crews fight wildfires with shovels and chainsaws. In Florida, the main tool is the bulldozer. Jeff Radakovic with Florida's Forest Service says the real work is done by what the bulldozer is pulling, a plow.
What it does is just like a plow they use on the farm fields. It digs a trench basically into the ground.
In Florida, there are more than 16 million acres of forest and massive expanses of grasslands extending through the Everglades. In 2011, a bad year for fires here, two firefighters were using bulldozers to dig breaks around a small blaze when both got stuck on tree stumps. Radakovic says for a bulldozer operator, running onto a stump is a bad deal.
It gets them off the ground. And if that happens, it's difficult to get off of it, especially in a situation like they were in where the fire was rocking on their door.
The firefighters abandoned their machines and were overtaken by fire before they could get to safety. The accident helped spur state officials to roll out an asset tracking system. Florida Forest Service Director Jim Carroll says a radio tracking device is now on bulldozers, trucks, and other vehicles they use to fight fires.
And a computer program that overlays it onto satellite imagery, and that the fire supervisor is then able to, from his truck at the fire, be able to monitor where his equipment are and what they're doing.
2 years after Florida's fatal fire, a much larger fire in Arizona grabbed the nation's attention.
19 firefighters were killed yesterday as they battled a wildfire in the small community of Yarnell.
Carroll's traveled from Florida to direct the investigation in Arizona. He says that disaster again showed the need to improve communications and find a way to track crews fighting wildfires.
Even in our day and age, communications can be somewhat a struggle, whether it's remote conditions of the West or whether it's remote conditions of the swamps of Florida.
Go ahead, 37.
Okay, got you. Why don't you just hold up? We'll probably run.
Forest Service Supervisor Chris Wassel sits in his SUV at a wildlife refuge in Palm Beach County. It's nearly 800 acres of pines, saw palmetto, and scrubs surrounded by subdivisions. Wassel scans his laptop with a map pinpointing where his firefighters and their equipment are located.
Yeah, this Everglades 37 is that bulldozer that's already.
Okay.
And I'm the green dot on here, so I can see, of course, where I'm at on the map also.
The map shows the bulldozer's track, its coordinates, and speed. Quassel and his crew just started using the new asset tracker and haven't yet tested it on a big fire. But he expects it will be useful, especially when he studies aerial maps and coordinates tactics during a wildfire.
Like you can see on here, as this bulldozer's moving, there's a big wetland area here, mm-hmm. you know, and to where I could even let him know it's a good safety area if he had maybe had to get into and get out if mm-hmm. he was getting in here, or it might not be a good idea to go through it.
Florida Forest Service is using the tracker right now just on its equipment. Director Jim Carrolls believes the system can be adapted to track people as well as vehicles. On large wildfires in the West, though, dozens of agencies and contract crews often pitch in with 1,000 firefighters. The biggest challenge may be one not of technology, but of coordination. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. According to data released by the music streaming service Spotify, 20% of the songs in its catalog have never been listened to. That's about 4 million tracks that have gone unheard on Spotify.
Undiscovered.
And some have simply been forgotten.
That is, until now. Enter Forgotify.com.
Forgotify takes the basically 4 million songs that are on Spotify that have never been played once and plays them.
That's Nate Gagnon, one of the website's co-founders.
It's kind of like what it seems to be is a musical tour through foreign countries and previous decades mostly, but there's some really interesting, cool stuff on there.
Why don't you see things my way?
Perhaps not so blue now. Those songs, Tuck Away My Lonesome Blues by country singer Hank Snow.
Three Dances by Duke Ellington.
Viento Viento by Spanish singer Joselito.
Mozart's Quartet in D Major by Bulgarian musician Dmitri Gergiev.
And 3 Years Long by the band Relayer.
Here's the thing about Forgotify. Once you listen to a song, forget it. Again, co-founder Nate Gagnon.
On the site, what we do is if it's played, then it gets flagged, and we basically refresh it every day. And refreshing it then gets rid of that one song in there.
One, or rather one play, may be the loneliest number, but it sure beats zero.
Porsche. The name is almost a synonym for sleek and fast. But the first car that Ferdinand Porsche designed in 1898, when he was just 22, was boxy-looking and sputtered over streets at 21 miles per hour. And the P1 was powered by electricity. The car has been parked in a garage in Austria since 1902. It is now on display at the Porsche Museum in Stuttgart-Zuffenhausen. We're joined now by the director of that museum, Achim Steskal. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
So to look at it, would it look like a car or more of a carriage with the horses gone?
Honestly, it looks totally different than a Porsche looks like today. It looks more like a carriage.
Now, why was this powered by electricity as opposed to gas?
In the time where Ferdinand Porsche invented the first cars, there were three engine types competing to each other. This was gas, steam, and the other engine was electrical power. And for Ferdinand Porsche, his true interest was in the field of electricity, and so he was very keen on creating very efficient electrical cars.
Efficient? So that was a consideration even then in 1898?
Yes, of course. Even other aspects which are today very interesting, for example, pollution or noise reduction. So this was also the interest of Ferdinand Porsche to create an electric car because there was no emission, there was no noise. Yeah.
So why didn't it go into production widespread?
It went into production a few years later. In the year 1900, he further developed the idea of an electrical car with a hybrid system. So in addition to the electrical power supply, he placed two combustion engines in another car, and a few cars were sold as the first hybrid cars in the world in the year 1902.
So why did the combustion engine become predominant in the industry, do you think?
The problem was the weight of the cars. This battery pack weighs around 500 kilograms, so this was almost half the weight of the whole car. And the combustion engines, they were much smaller then, so I think it turned from the electrical engines into the combustion engines, and then they made their way to the successful, still successful power supply for the cars of the future.
Have you been in the car, Mr. Sesko?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Does it work? Have you taken it for a spin?
We intentionally avoided to drive the car, but yeah. What is really interesting, after 116 years, we connected this, we call it octagon engine because of the shape of the exterior of the engine, and we connected it to a battery supply, mm-hmm. and the engine is still working today.
So you've started it up?
We started it up, and it's working.
Well, Mr. Sesko, thanks. Happy trails to you, sir.
Thank you. Likewise, and it was great talking to you.
Achim Steskel is director of the Porsche Museum. This is NPR News.